mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world, then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags-to-riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires, many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
Welcome to Ditch Digger CEO today. We've got an awesome young man on board with us today, an entrepreneur that you guys are gonna get a kick out of. You know, Joe Riley, a military hero of mine. Everybody that serves in the military does their service is a hero of mine. Not able to do it myself. I want to respect my friends that do, and got to give respect for Joe for serving the military and serving our country. So I love having past military people on the show because they know what it's like. They serve our country, and then they move on and jump into business as entrepreneurs and take advantage of the fruits of their labor by being part of this great freedom, free enterprise world that we live in. So. Welcome, Joel Riley. Joel, thanks for being on today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you, and huge fan of what you're doing to help kind of educate and mentor the entrepreneur community, and as people are trying to travel down the same path that you traveled down and did so successfully. So thanks for including me in this, and thanks for everything that you do for so many other entrepreneurs out there.
And the cool thing about this too, Joe, is, there's on this path of entrepreneurship, I don't care how old you are, there's people ahead of you in this path that we can learn from, and there's people behind us on the path that we can help mentor and learn from, right? So again, when I was a younger guy, I was just out trying to learn the word that I could that had any type of success at all as an entrepreneur. And I found some people that are still, became my mentors and are still my mentors today as they're in their 70s, 80s, 90s even. I realized the value it's been for me. So my goal is to continue that on and make sure that I can provide some type of education platform to mentor people. And that, Ditch Digger CEO, anybody that listens to this gets a ton out of it, myself included. And it's been a lot of fun doing it. So you are just another great example of what that is in the world of mentorship and entrepreneurship. So thanks for being on board. So we want to dig into Joel Riley, the kid that decided to serve in the military. I want you to just tell a little bit about your upbringing and what made you want to be in the service, and a little bit about the service once you get there.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in East Tennessee, and didn't even want to go to college for a while, and I was we didn't have a computer. In my house I grew up in is black and white TV. We didn't have internet or anything like that. And the first computer I worked with was when I got to high school, and we had keyboarding class. If that would be funny for some people, that the one business class that my high school offered was keyboarding. And I was no good at typing. And so I failed my first test. And the teacher said, Joe, you failed the test. It says, you're no good for typing, but you're a loud mouth and you love to talk. She says, they've got this club called Future Business Leaders of America. And if you enter this public speaking competition, I'll give you an A on this test you just failed. And so I thought, well, that's pretty easy. So I did the speech and won the local level. And she says, all right, if you go to the regional level, I'll give you an A on the next test. And I thought, well, that sounds easy enough. So I went there and won that one. She says, if you go to state, I'll give you an A for the semester. And I thought, that sounds like a good deal. And so won the state, and she says, you go to nationals and I'll give you an A from any class you ever take from me. So I thought, well, that's easy enough. So I went to nationals. Then I said, I told her we were in this big conference in Atlanta, there's about 16,000 kids or so. And I said, I want to be national president of Future Business Leaders of America. And she said, yeah, that's funny. We've never even had a district officer And I said, no, we'll do it. And so I went back and I ran for, you know, started in my comfort zone of 4-H and got elected 4-H governor and then Boise State governor and then went on to run and be the state president for FBLA and then the national president and then president of Boise Nation. So that then, you know, went from not wanting to go to school and got a scholarship to go to UVA and and I'd gotten into several of the Ivies as well, but UVA said, if you come here, you know, the Army is going to pay for your school and the ROTC scholarship will give you the check in cash for the scholarship. So I thought, go to Harvard or get 70 grand a year in cash to go to UVA. So, and I had a great time at UVA. So I went to UVA, took the kind of scholarship money, used that to invest starting in 2009, which became the kind of seed capital for the things we did after that. And at UVA was fortunate enough to get the Rhodes Scholarship to go over to the UK and Oxford. And so did my master's and doctorate over there, met my wife and much better half there. I told her, laughed and said I was the only Southern Christian conservative in Oxford. So she had no other choices to choose from, which is the only way I got her. But she was also on the Rhodes. And so did our doctorates there. I came back to the Army. Like many military families, we moved 8 times in 9 years, or something like that. 9 times in 8 years. I kind of forget which one it was. And in one of the deployments to Afghanistan, Rachel's a partner at McKinsey. And so she travels, you know, Monday through Thursday or Friday. And so I thought, you know, we had this house and I was in Afghanistan. So I thought, well, we'll just throw it up on Airbnb and HomeAway. And quickly realized, no surprise, there's a big need for furnished accommodations around military bases. And so came back and I didn't want to give up the cash flow. So I moved Rachel and I into one bedroom of our 3-bedroom house. I started renting out the other 2 rooms to randos. We'd brought this dog back from the UK. I decided, you know, the dog's balance sheet was in the red. So then without telling Rachel, I bred the dog. So then we were living in one bedroom of our 3-bedroom house with 2 dogs and 10 puppies. And on the weekends, we would drive around flipping houses. So we'd move in my truck. So I thought, well, Rachel doesn't need her car because she travels to work Monday through Thursday or Friday. And then we'd drive around my truck on the weekends. So she came home that weekend. She says, where's my car? And I said, well, I leased it. And she said, you leased it? And I said, yeah, you don't need it. She says, you're going to learn that not every capital asset in this household has to yield a monthly return.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So if you're a husband out there and an entrepreneur or what, you know, and your spouse is giving you a hard time, you can just tell them my story that, you know, just tell them it could be worse. You could be married to a person who, shoved you into one bedroom of a 3-bedroom house, bred, had 10 puppies and took away your car. So,
I love it. I love it. You know, and my story is a little bit similar to that. Not quite. I'm an entrepreneur, but you're like an entrepreneur on steroids. And I found a dog. I had a bunch of little business when I started out. I was trying to start a paving business, seal coating driveways and packing driveways. And I split wood and sold firewood in the wintertime. And I still plowed. I did all different bid jobs to make money. And I, on the way to selling firewood to at this place, I used to sell my firewood to a person that would buy a bunch of it. And there was a stray German Shepherd on the side of the road, and pulled over to check it out. No collars on or anything like that. And, just thought somebody's dog. Didn't do much, and came back 2 hours later and sent a couple miles down the road. That same Shepherd was there again with another German Shepherd, and no collar in that one either. So I brought them both home, and I brought them to the vet to get them checked out and all that. And turned out one was pregnant, and. So like you, this is within, 6 months, you know, a few months of getting married in 1985. And, we had 10 dogs within, I think, 4 months of being married and, in a small house, 3-bedroom, 1500 square foot house in the wintertime in the Chicagoland area. That was a stinky thing. I mean, it was, you know, pretty crazy, but either way, it was funny because we had 10 dogs. I ended up, selling them all. And they were like, they're lab Shepherd mixies, but sold them all for, you know, $100, a couple $100 a piece, whatever it was. And, it was kind of funny, but either way for me, I did something. So I would, first house we had was a rundown house we remodeled. And as soon as my wife did, I worked 7 days a week. So my wife did hair. she basically remodeled the house on her own. By the time she got the house all the way she wanted it, I sold it. We made like 50 grand on that first house. It was one of the biggest deals I ever imagined making, right, in a real estate deal back then. And just kind of funny though. She's like, wait a minute, I just got this thing remodeled. It's perfect. This is what I want. I said, yeah, babe, now we can move up to the next opportunity. And we rented for a little while I figured out how to buy a lot and build a house. But either way, my wife would scratch her head in this relationship also early on. But that's the same type of mentality is one that will build great businesses, that will continue to figure out value propositions for your, customers that you can serve, and value propositions that can serve them better than your competition, as you're constantly thinking. And so our business has started out seal coating, paving driveways. Today, we pave more parking lots, we think, than anybody in America, but also have a bunch of other companies. We have 13 companies, 5 are paving, and we have a couple technology companies and roofing and all different things we do. But the relationships, the business have all spun out of, serving a customer with a product that we know that we thought they would like. And then once they like it, the service within the business becomes a business on its own and spins out as a business. Kind of, it sounds like you've kind of got a similar mentality where if there's an opportunity, it's knocking. You're probably going to open that door and look at that next opportunity as another business. That's pretty awesome. So tell us that. So, I mean, served in the military, Oxford, man, you're crazy educated. I mean, your wife is too. She's a McKinsey partner. That's a big deal. So you two both are highly educated, but yet, and the thing I find sometimes it's hard when my friends are really, really well educated, are great at whatever professional services they're into, whether it's legal, whether it's medical, accounting, right? But the entrepreneurial thing doesn't always click when they've been educated so highly. The entrepreneurial life is one of a little bit of risk, creativity, and often those minds don't work as well in the entrepreneurial world. Yours is one that's a little different in that you served in the military, you're highly educated, and you're an entrepreneur. I mean, you're voted for bear, buddy. That's pretty cool. Tell me about how you became how that worked out. Like when you went to Oxford, you've seen some of the most educated people in the world, and I'm sure many of your friends. The entrepreneurial life isn't one that's always comfortable for a lot of my friends who are highly educated like that.
No, I guess I was just I tell people I was not. I'm the most unintellectual person to ever go there, which is why I was able to do the dissertation, on kind of record pace, because I didn't waste time getting wrapped up in all the little nuances. I knew what I was there to do: get done, get out, and move on. I think that, I think I'm much more of an entrepreneur than an academic. It was almost like an academic by accident. Of like, I had in my mind that as this country kid, you got to get a scholarship. You get a scholarship. All right, now I'm in college. Now what's the next scholarship? Oh, there's this scholarship, so I'll apply for that. And then you just kind of tell funny stories from growing up on the farm, and the next thing you're somewhere you probably don't belong. But so in terms of starting the business, though, I mean, it really was just that, right? I mean, we threw the house up on Airbnb in Hawaii, realized there was a need. This came back, got another one, took out my first big loan. The Army said, surprise, you're going to Ukraine. So I thought, this is how I go bankrupt, because how do I manage an operationally intensive short-term rental portfolio from a shipping container in rural Ukraine where I was living with 3 other guys? And, God works things out in interesting ways, because one of the guys I was deploying with, his wife had been a West Point grad, Army officer, gotten out, did real estate, and said, look, Kate will kind of take care of things while we're deployed. And that unlocked what has become kind of our secret sauce, which is this awesome group of military spouses that are overqualified, underemployed, because they have to move all the time and they need flexible, portable employment. And so going to Ukraine was in what allowed us to, expand out the business, because it forced me to start building a team that could run things instead of just having me do everything. And so we moved from Fort Benning to other military bases, and we'd be in a military base next to a university town. And we realized, oh, well, there's, people need short-term rentals around college towns too, or need them in state capitals, or there's, major hospital systems where people are receiving treatment, or travel nurses, or where there's a lot of construction going on and there's travel plumbers and electricians. And so we just kind of grew. You know, I tell people all the time, the accountants on the team often want to like rip my head off because they're like, how did you put together this messy, you know, series of, you know, things? And it was just, there was no plan. It was just, you know, well, this works, so we'll do some more of this, and that doesn't work, so we'll kind of stop doing that. But then ultimately, you know, and then when we'd run out of capital, we also started running a rental arbitrage business. So I didn't have any more money to buy homes. So I'd come to you and say, hey, I'll lease your home for 5 years, guarantee you the lease, and then turn around and I'll short-term rental, arbitrage the difference. Then landlords came to us and said, hey, how are you paying our rent and making money on top of that? Do you want to just manage for us? So we said, sure. And then we had folks who came to us and said, well, look, I don't have a portfolio of homes, but I think what you're doing is interesting. Here's $5 million, whatever else, $10 million. Can you just go find me the homes? And so then we fully vertically integrated. So we've got a acquisitions department, a renovation department. We've got our own warehouses where we procure the FF&E. And then we've got a openings team that goes and installs it in the homes, and then an ongoing management and guest services and accounting team. And so we've then spread out over the course of the past couple of years. We're now in about 37 different markets across the Southeast, Midwest, moving out as far west as Texas, as far north as Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And
okay, so back up a minute. How many years ago was that when you were deployed to Ukraine?
I was in Ukraine in 2019.
Wow, it's amazing that all this in that short period of time.
And then when I came back from the Ukraine, yeah, I went to the White House and I ran our counter China policy for the last helped run the counter China policy on the National Security Council the last 18 months of the Trump administration. So again, was a forcing function for me to start building a team because, you know, as bad as it was trying to run this from Ukraine, it was way harder, you know, trying to do it there. So,
wow, that's interesting. Okay, so 2019, when you went in Ukraine, how many properties were you managing? How many did you own, manage, whatever? Whatever data points you use when you look at where you were and where you're at today, kind of just share those with us.
We had about 10 properties in one market when I went to Ukraine, and then by the end of 2019, we were up to like 50 properties. And then at the end of 2020, we were up to about 100 properties. And then I left the Army in 2021, and we went from about 100 to 300 or so properties in 2021. And then over 2022, we slowed down a little bit based on just kind of where the economy was with home prices and a lot of other stuff. And we took the kind of success we'd had and went out to go raise capital really for kind of the first time. And so then we just closed in the fourth quarter on a $60 million raise to go out and buy a bunch more homes and expand out the team. And so we're now, having closed that, we're in January and we've started buying homes in cash and are putting in place several different lending facilities, working with regional banks and then a couple national banks as well. So that's kind of how we, from a scaling standpoint, how we got here.
So what's your goal by the end of 2023? What's your vision for, you know, how many homes you'll have by the end of 2023? But you gotta basically, get that capital working, right?
Yeah. We have a budget for 700, and, I've got a stretch goal of 1,000, which will require, getting some, pulling some more rabbits out of hats.
So
700 over 1,000.
Okay. So you raise the capital. So the interest rates, I mean, they got to affect you, but not quite as much as if your partner is a bank, right? I mean, tell me about that. Tell me about the, you know, raising capital as you did compared to, if you have a bank that's your partner.
So we built everything up until this point off of debt and cash flow, and then recognizing kind of where the economy was going, knew a couple of things. One, we needed to front load a bunch of hires, whereas historically we let people follow revenue. To kind of go to the next level, we needed to make some investments in a variety of things, and that was just needed us to raise capital into the operating company. And then obviously to go buy more homes, it's a capital intensive deal. So, you know, the goal would be typically about 65% leverage. So we buy 50, you know, have $50 million in equity to buy homes, try to go get $100 million worth of debt to buy $150 million worth of homes. So that's kind of the way we think about it. Interest rates definitely are, you know, impacting us. I mean, I would frankly, you know, if you had a high interest rates and the home prices came down, that's ideal, right? Because I'd rather buy in a high interest rate environment, have a low cost basis, and then in 24, 36 months, if rates drop, you refi out, you get a lower rate, you get the equity value from the appreciated value of the home as a result of, you know, home prices going up in a lower rate environment. But the challenge facing right now is that the home prices haven't come down commensurate with the increase in interest rates. So
now
this is a challenge. We still target a 10% cap rate in terms of what we're buying single family homes for, which is, you know, way better than what the industry was, which is around a 5-6.
Explain the cap rate to people listening that might understand that.
So cap rate would be basically saying, what's your run rate profit, assuming no debt and no, and, you know, pre-debt, pre-interest, pre-taxes, pre-depreciation and non-cash expenses. So what's just kind of, you had no debt on it, what would be your run rate operating income? And then you divide that by the value of the asset. So if you had $10,000 of profit on a $100,000 house, you'd have a 10% cap rate.
Yep.
Okay. And so that's a way to evaluate the productivity of different, you know, types of real estate, right? Because I may be willing to put 85% leverage, and you may only put 50% leverage, and I may have a 3% interest rate, and you may have a 7 or 8% interest rate. So if you look at the ultimate IRR or the net income, that's not necessarily a neutral or kind of fair comparison of one asset to another. But the better way to look at it is if you had no debt, what would be the performance of that asset, and then compare the two. So.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's the only way to look at that. So I appreciate you explaining that. All right. So when we think about, you know, the future, are you the visionary and the operations minded leader, or do you have teammates that do different things? Or tell me about your leadership team right now. Is it you and you, or is it you and a couple others? And how do you go about looking at, you know, 1, 3, 5 year plans and, you know, the vision for the future?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a tremendous team, and we could not do it without the whole team all the way up and down the kind of chain of command. If you look at the senior leadership, so we'll call it the big four in the company right now. So the lady who I mentioned, who kind of took things over while I went to Ukraine, she stayed with us all along, and she's done every job from cleaning houses, renovating houses, talking with guests on the phone. She's kind of done it all. And, you know, she's still married to her husband. They live at West Point, New York, where he's a professor. She serves as our kind of chief growth officer. And so she manages the pipeline as new properties are coming in. She's the kind of, you know, typical, you know, former military officer, very execution oriented, you know, and keeps people on track. Our chief strategy officer is Luke Brennan. He was my, kind of best friend in college and fraternity brother. Went to BCG, worked in hospitality and real estate there. And he really is what you think of as kind of the strategy, you know, he takes a problem and runs all the way down to the kind of root of it, and has a photographic memory, knows everything that's going on in the financials. And, you know, so he is the kind of knowing where all of the detail lives and thinking through, are we going to look at this business model or that business model? So I have 100 ideas a day, you know, he tries to sift through them. And then we just hired in January 1st.
Oh, by the way, wait, let me tell you, that photographic memory thing, that's an unfair advantage. You know, I've got only a couple of people I know in my life that have a photographic memory. It's not fair to the rest of us, I'll tell you.
Two funny stories on him. One, in college, he used to think it was funny to see how many beers he could drink and take his computer completely apart and reassemble it just for the kind of fun of it. And then we went on this trip through Asia together. And I would go, you know, I was in ROTC, so I was trying to stay in shape. So I'd go work out at the gym. He'd stay back in the hotel room, have a couple, several drinks, and he'd just read the like little resort book. And then we'd play a game, and I'd come back in and I'd be like, page 7, paragraph 4, sentence 3. And he'd, you know, so it's a, it's an unfair advantage for sure. And he's a huge intellectual powerhouse on the team. And then our the other core who we just hired to be our president and COO is a guy named Christian Hempel. He ran all of Saunders, which is kind of one of our large-scaled competitors, North American operations. And then before that, kind of grew up in IHG, you know, and held all sorts of different jobs at brand, brand management, marketing, you name it. And so he's the one person on the team who, from a hospitality, he has seen the other side of scale, right? He's led 1,000-plus person teams. And so we brought him in January as really the integrator, as you said, you know, to kind of take all of these different working pieces together from and put them on a path to fully scale up. So that's the kind of the way the team breaks down right now is I come up with a bunch.
What's the gal's name that was that been on your team since you went to went off to Ukraine?
Kate. Mm-hmm. Kate Ami. So it's Kate, Luke, and Christian are the three people who keep me in line.
Awesome. And you need those. You know, if you're a visionary like I am, I love being a visionary, but if it was just me and my vision, we'd be out of business.
You'd have 64 businesses.
I'd have 64 attempted businesses probably.
Yeah, that's right.
And not enough successful ones to be above water. But right. I learned it took me a while to learn that, right? That I needed people that were operationally minded, stronger than I was, execution minded to kind of pull me back on my vision. Because, you know, vision's great, but if you don't have a plan and you don't have a team to execute on the plan that believes in the plan as much as you do, right? It's not happening. And so there's a thing called, you ever heard the book Traction EOS process? We use that. We've been using that for 5 or 6 years now. Entrepreneurial operating system, and basically tells you that, right? And you have your quarterly meetings, annual meeting, all that, and you basically make sure that visionary doesn't go crazy and astray by having the operations team and the execution team that's there to help pull, you know, help buy into the vision, help build the vision, buy into the vision, pull back on a crazy visionary like myself who thinks we can do way more than we can. And it works. It works pretty well because, you know, we can have all the vision in the world, but if everybody around us doesn't share that vision, it's not working out too well, right?
Nope.
So it's cool. You've got this team of amazing people. Tell me about this. So I'm going to be buying paving companies across America. I'm going to be buying mostly red states, believe it or not. I'm a conservative guy. I ran for governor in Illinois, and I'm kind of conservative, and I'm really upset. And how far, against free enterprise, some of the blue states are going, just taxing business more than ever, and penalizing them for being successful when they are successful. And take all the risk in the world, and if you survive, now we're going to tax the heck out of you, you rich son of a gun. And if you fail, you fail. That's just the way it goes. That's a cost doing business, right? And that's the attitude we have in my home state of Illinois today. And again, so we're very large in our industry in our state, and we're blessed to be able to do well there. But it's not easy. And so we're in Texas and Maryland and other markets. Now we're going to be growing across the country. And so when I do this, though, my biggest challenge, yours too, in the future, we're going to be the first billion-dollar brand in our industry. And to do that, my biggest challenge will be really grooming and mentoring leaders, right? Leaders to lead in all markets. And when I think about you and the blessings you have to be so ingrained in the military world, I think that's pretty cool because some of my best leaders are past military. And man, I can't find enough good people that have the understanding what leadership, real leadership looks like. And so is there a network or something like that that can be tapped into if people say, I gotta find 25 to 30 kind of small CEOs to be large CEOs as the businesses grow market by market that will be partners with me, right? In these businesses. Is there a place to look for that? Is there a place to access, you know, people that have been in the military, understand what leadership's about, understand what service is about, right? That a person from the outside like myself or you, right, growing your businesses can tap into?
Yeah, so there's a great program called the Career Skill Bridge Program, where the military will actually continue to pay their salary for 6 months. So you get them for free for 6 months. And you,
it's called the Career Still. Say that again. Career Still
Bridge Program, CSP. So like our company is an approved provider of this. And so at any given time, we've got probably 5-6 plus, folks who are transitioning out of the military and want to come and do an internship. And so we get them from somewhere between 2 to 6 months. We like to have them for 6 months, and we teach them about, if they're interested in acquisitions, they work with the acquisitions department. Some of them go work in the ops department. So we find out within the kind of broader real estate, hospitality, business development space, what their interests are. And then we go turn them loose. And they're not all successes. You know, I actually caution a lot of guys and gals getting out of the military who want to go be entrepreneurs, because the military is the biggest bureaucracy that there is, right? And one thing that I have to deliver some tough love to folks in the military is they come out, they're like, you know, like, oh, I built this system and I built this system and I did that. And I'm like, you didn't build any systems in the military. Literally, this is the most bureaucratized organization, 200 plus years of people building you systems. And everybody who showed up to work for you had gone through a common curriculum and a common training program, spoke a common language, had great benefits, had, you know, like, you know, you learned a lot about leadership and how to motivate and lead people. So like lean in on that, but you did not build systems. You refined systems within an existing operating structure. And so like, you got to be honest with yourself about that. And then the second reason, and this is why I often like hiring the military spouses more than the veterans, candidly, is that it's because how do you win wars? You throw more people at the prop, you know, so like, and if you've been in the military, you've never had to internalize labor cost. So when military guys, particularly long-term career military guys, when they see a problem, they're like, I need a person for this and a person for that and a person for this and a person for that. And I'm like, whoa, you need a better process.
Yeah.
Let's think about process before we think about people, because I understand that the taxpayers of America have been footing your labor cost for the past, you know, how many ever years, but that's not the case anymore. And, you know, we don't
rate points.
We don't get continuing resolutions to, you know, to fund labor imbalances. So anyway, so military folks are awesome. They're going to be great, loyal, you know, team members. They bring a lot of leadership skills. They're perfect to put into systems that are already running and just need some refinement. Where they struggle is if you just, and some people rise above this, right? There's great entrepreneurs, but in general, the military system does not prepare someone to just receive a white canvas and say, go make something, right? They do is say, here's a team moving out on this mission and vision. We need you to go motivate, morale, manage, push them, you know, harder, faster in that direction. And then you got to be very clear with them about, like, we are not here to give jobs. We are here to do a job, and we're going to try to do the job with as few people as possible.
Absolutely. Yeah. To be able to turn a profit and, you know, work within a budget and all that, that's something they're probably quite used to. But yeah, you know, the part of that though is invaluable. Like, you know, for us, we're blessed that we've grown, you know, mostly organically with very little acquisitions and, with our own, you know, own cash, mine and my bank, we're working together to continue to provide funding. And now we want to grow across the country and we've got some amazing technology on board in our businesses that differentiate us from our competition worldwide. And so we're confident if we have the right person that understands leadership and how to serve our customers better than anybody else, we can apply the structure that we have with somebody that continually think about, you know, how to deliver on that structure, you know, maintaining an amazing culture, like amazing core values, holding people accountable to their tasks, and then really, you know, just serving our customers better than anybody else in the marketplace, and work out if we can do that market by market. But it sounds like there's a chance that we've got opportunity. I definitely would love to talk to you more about that offline. And then the military spouses, then how do you go about finding spouses? I mean, you're connected. Somebody like me is not.
You know, I've got another business for you there. I'll find them and send them to you, you know.
There you go. All right.
No, I mean, there are a couple different sites, and I can send those to you. I admittedly we recruit based off our own kind of own networks, and I tell people, yeah, I run this nice clean Army organization, and then I hired this one military spouse, and then she like hired all these other, Marine Corps spouses. She hired all these other Marine Corps spouses. And so then like the Marine Corps, like temporarily like took over my company. And, you know, I'm trying to now get back, the Army, at least the parity with Marine Corps. a huge portion of it is informal networks for us, but there are definitely some sites. And I'm blanking right now on what they are that, you know, can go to help facilitate that.
So Joel, let's get into your business a little more here. Now, I mean, I'm a little familiar with you, what you're doing. We're into commercial industrial real estate as our customers. So we pave parking lots in concrete, parking lots in asphalt, and we have roofing maintenance companies. We do all repaving and re-roofing and doors and dock. We have a bunch of different companies, but paving is our biggest thing. And then we have technology that backs these companies up we do assessment using drones to assess the quality of roofs and pavements of our customers' properties and properties across the globe today. And so we have a lot of fun doing all these things. And the whole idea is we serve our customer better than anybody else in the world. We're gonna gain their opportunity, their respect, and their friendships, and do a lot of business, right? And we're confident that if we find the right people, we'll continue to think outside the box and differentiate to separate ourselves from our competition. The Blue Ocean Strategy, as you may have read the old Blue Ocean Strategy book that was written years ago, it's about differentiation to separate yourself from the competition, right? To swim in blue oceans, not shark infested, blood infested, competitive oceans, right? And so again, we do that in every way we can. Part of our mission is to differentiate and serve our customers better than anybody else. And our teammates, our leaders, all get that. And so we're constantly managing what are we doing today to invest in innovation to differentiate. You've got competition. I mean, a friend of mine is a big builder and it's building thousands of homes for I think it's Blackstone or something like that. That's doing all these big rentals, huge subdivisions that are renting them all out, right? That's probably kind of a competitor, right? Who are your competitors out there? How are you going to stay, differentiating from them and continue to kick their butts, right? Yeah, maybe be huge. They have millions of homes, right? But how do you take advantage of that big, slow moving ship that they become to stay nimble and differentiating very strong continually to be uber successful in the future?
Yeah. So we think our hedgehog concept is, running economy style short-term rentals, right? So let's think about where we sit. So if you think about the kind of $1 million beach home, mountain home, traditional vacation home, that's on one end, right? And then the Blackstone single family 12-month rental, homes are on the other end, right? And what we do is we live in between, and there's a ton of people playing in the luxury vacation rental space, and there's a ton of people playing in the standard fare single family rental space. What we do is we say, we agree that there's additional revenue potential from turning a property faster instead of doing it just once a 12 months, doing it, and sometimes 50, 60 times a year, the way we operate ours. But we think that the value proposition for the asset owning entity is not to own the $2 million beach home. I would rather make $50,000 or $60,000 a year of top line revenue on a $220,000 house than $150,000 a year in top line revenue on a $2 million house, right?
Yeah, so of course.
But the management company, if I'm just a management company, right? If I don't care about the value of the underlying asset, I want to manage $2 million house, because what do I care what you paid for your vacation home, right? I just want my 30% of the
bigger number
revenue, right? And two, most people in the, hospitality space, they want to do luxury because that's what's inspiring. They don't want to run. So we tell people we're the Walmart of short-term rentals, right? And that means we're running run-of-the-mill homes and run-of-the-mill towns for run-of-the-mill folks. We're not in your super sexy markets. We're not running super sexy houses. We run and budget accommodation, short-term rentals, and we do that for traveling plumbers, electricians, large family members. And so if you look at who stays in our homes, this blows people's mind all the time. The number one reason why people stay with us is funerals. Because let's say mom or dad passes away, you come back to your hometown, you need a place to stay. That's a piece of our business. Let's say you're a group of traveling electricians or plumbers and you're doing a, even your crews, Gary, who are out on you know, traveling to do some other job site. Okay, you can put them up and give each guy a hotel room and pay for four or five hotel rooms and then have to give them a food budget. Or you could put them in our three or four bedroom house. They have, you know, their own bedroom. They have a kitchen. They've got, you know, garage, place to park, store their tools, you know. And so that's where we play is in this, but nobody wants to do managing of the short-term rentals in the economy space because it's a dirty fingernail business, right? You're not dealing with great big nice homes. You don't have huge revenue numbers to slice a commission from. But what we've said is, in the same way that we think Walmart came to dominate the retail space by going out into the tertiary markets where there was not a ton of competition, really developing an operating model that could thrive in that environment and then turning that operating model to go after the big juicy markets where, you know, Sears and JCPenney and everybody else have, like, you know, used to living on a lot of fat, and then we're able to eviscerate them by the operational efficiency that they developed by being out in the tertiary market. So that's what we want to do. And we also think that because we can then offer a much higher and predictable rate of return for the asset owning entity, so now I don't have to go pay huge amounts of money to acquire another management company or to market to get an individual homeowner. I have, you know, an institutional investor style partner that says, we want you to go buy homes for us because we're, you know, convinced of the yield on those homes. And so then we get paid an acquisition fee where there's a margin on that. We get paid a renovation oversight fee where there's a margin. So instead of bleeding cash to grow inventory, some of our most profitable ancillary services are actually our growth ancillaries.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's awesome. Man, I'm telling you right now, we need to do business with you. I've got two of my businesses, they're national businesses that travel cruise, right? Yeah, but I know my partners and their leaders, they go to VRBO or whatever, and they look up places and they do this. Buddy Kata Suites or whatever. I'm trying to think of the name of the places they use, but either way, they'll use a little suite hotel sometimes, right? Which are, if you look at the cost of those and the value you get, can't be close to what you're talking about. And what we've done once in a while, right, where we found a decent little house and, you know, three bedroom, four bedrooms, and you got four or five guys staying at the same place, using a nice kitchen, hanging out, and more comfortable, right? And they're actually a little team building, getting to know each other better. So again, I like this model. It's awesome, and you're the niche of it, the economy niche of it. I agree. So many of these companies I'm seeing are, you know, in mid range, $500,000 homes, $700,000 homes, whatever. My buddy that's building all over the country is more in that range, and I don't see that as something, you know, we could ever use. But what you're doing, anybody could use that. I mean, that's good. So what's kind of the range, price range? If you look at, let's just say you're gonna add, you know, a few hundred homes this year. What would be that, if you threw a dart, probably the average price range?
Average would be about 200, within about $25,000 in reno and, you know, somewhere around in there. I mean, we're buying homes right now for $80,000, right? You know, and so, you know, it all depends on the market. And again, our $80,000 houses, I bet you 8 times out of 10 are going to perform better than the $200,000 houses.
Yeah.
It's a numbers game, but you get the denominator smaller and the difference in what people are willing to pay for the $80,000 four bedroom house versus the $200,000 four bedroom house is not as much as you might think. And then we also
know.
So one last thing. So your buddies, you know, he's building for Blackstone, but a lot of other people are going out and buying scatter site single family rentals. But the benefit that we have is that we buy almost antithetical to what they buy, right? So they're looking for, you know, best schools districts, no busy roads, so no double yellow lines, no commercial in sight, no weird floor plans, no ADUs, none of that stuff, right? Well, that's what we love, right? Like, we love being next to commercial because then, you know, it's no one to be kind of frustrated. Busy streets, no problem. If your work crews are there for a week, what do they care what the school district is, right? So, like, we're able to, like, say, okay, where are all the big boys buying? All right, let's go to the, you know, let's move on the periphery of that and pick up stuff there.
Absolutely. I love it. That's a cool model, man. You're you're this is going to be so successful. It's going to be fun to watch. How old are you now, Joe?
32.
32? You're a punk kid, man. That's awesome. 32 years old and already out of your way like this. It's so cool to see. Now, think about at 32 years old, I mean, you know, you've learned a lot of leadership already. What are a few of the lessons you feel like have gotten you this far? What are the, whether it be, you know, the mentorship that, you know, what who's inspired you? That teacher you talk about, it's pretty cool. Think of that teacher that, you know, said, you know, you're not that good at this, but I think you're pretty good at this. You do this, so I'll give you A's on this side, even though you stink at it, right? I mean, that was pretty cool. But who in your life were your mentors, and what are the kind of messages of leadership they gave you that made you successful today and will continue in the future to make it, you know, keep you inspired to be the best you can be?
Well, I mean, the number one person I have to thank is my wife, because, you know, she's the original integrator. And if not for her, I would have bankrupted us, you know, at least 6 or 7 times at this point. So she's the main one that keeps me, you know, on the right path and not too crazy. My grandfather, I've got both my grandfathers, you know, one was a Baptist minister who ran the prison ministry for the state. And then he built a rehabilitation center for men leaving prison and recovering from drug and alcohol addiction. And we now, that's who makes most of our furniture. So we built them a wood shop. So the men leaving prison learn how to do woodworking skills. They build the furniture, which then gives us a cost basis much lower than any of our competitors, and the stuff never breaks. And then my other grandfather, you know, is kind of the typical, you know, self-made redneck businessman, you know, who, you know, built himself up from, you know, got a football scholarship to college and then started working out in a factory. And similar to you, he would take old waste boilers and break them down that people just abandoned, and then fix them up and then resell them and then get, you know, carbon tax credits and a bunch of other things, and had a rubber factory. And so, you know, he's where kind of my entrepreneurial, you know, spirit came from. And so, you know, but all of those folks, you know, what I would say my number one key to success is, when I look for people, I don't look for someone who's just like standard. And I'm not, you know, my mom says, you know, normal's just kind for boring, you know, they're people who are a little bit off one way or the other, right? They have something about that your standard, you know, kind of business or whatever else, or person would look at it and be like, ah, you know, that person's a little bit. But when you dig in, they're incredibly smart and they're extremely loyal and they work very hard, right? Because the fact that they're a little bit off, you know, and not in a bad sense, right? But they're not your kind of standard fare. There's something unique and special about them that might turn some people off. But if you can figure out how to harness and drive that and put those people together on a team, they work super hard, they're incredibly loyal, and they're often the most talented people that you can find.
And so tell me how you say that. I think differentiation, I really believe differentiate or die. If you don't differentiate personally, you know, what good are you to your wife? If you're not special to her and you're not different than anybody else she could find, why does she stay with you the rest of her life? If your best friend doesn't look at you as a different type of a guy, you know, differentiate because you're a special type of friend, right? Yeah, and you deserve that person as your best friend, right? And same thing with your customers. If you can't differentiate, they can't look at their investors and say, this is why I do business with Joe, because Joe gives me this, 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 and nobody gives me those things, right? That's about differentiation. You're speaking the same thing. I believe this. You know, I like people that differentiate. And sometimes when you interview people, they're different, like they have a little difference about it, something different about that person you're interviewing, right? And you dig deep and then you find out their story is incredible. You find out their experience is incredible. You find out that they've had challenges in their life that created a difference in the type of person they are today. So I like what you're saying, but is there a simple way to put that?
Yeah, I think that simple way to put it would be, you know, if you can find people that the rest of the workforce is undervaluing for some reason. Right. So take our military spouses, the employer base is undervalued. If most employers say, oh, those military, they're going to move every 12 months. Right. Okay, great. We'll design a system that allows, you know, design a system that allows them to move every 12 months. Right. Or, you know, this military veteran, you know, that you know, maybe they've seen some stuff and occasionally they like have, you know, some reactions that are a little bit more, you know, aggressive or assertive or something like that. Okay, coach them on how to do that. You find this person that, you know, they can be kind of difficult, right? Like, so what I love about Luke is like, he just cannot accept for anything to be wrong, right? And so that can make him really annoying to people, right? Because he'll just be like, you know, but that's incredibly valuable of making sure that you're staying centered on where you're going. So that, anyway, I don't know that there's a, look for people who are different, right? Just don't fill your team. It's the standard fare folks who, you know, have the, you know, and this is from somebody who's way overeducated and none of the education's done me any benefit of anything that I'm doing. Like, the who cares what's on the, where they went to school or what degree they have or anything like that. Look for somebody who's demonstrated success and who can, and in particular, so then the two last things I say in terms of hiring people, at least, if I'm going to hire somebody, I ask, I said, you know, have you had PL management, P&L management responsibility, right? And then if they say no, I mean, it depends on the role. You know, if you're a cleaner, maintenance, okay, that's fine. But if you're wanting to be a manager, right, if you had P&L management responsibility, they say no, then I have to dig a little bit further. But the real thing to drive on is if they say yes, then I say, okay, well, what was your last quarter's, you know, revenue, gross profit margin, EBITDA, and net income for, you know, trailing two? And, you know, so I start asking questions. And if they can answer that, that's a huge red flag for me, because either one, they don't remember it, which is a big problem. Two, they didn't care, which is a big problem. Or three, lying to me and never had P&L responsibility in the first place. So either way, it's a no-go. And then
I liked it. Okay, what's the third thing you're inside?
So then the last thing I would just say is, in terms of managing people, you know, I'll get particularly more executives, and I live on a farm here, which is our corporate headquarters is on our farm. And so we'll do something. I'll take them out on the road to do some cleaning or some maintenance work, you know, get them into the muddy boots nature of the business, because there's no place in a startup that's scaling for ego, right? Like, if you're in a hospitality company, you got to be willing to take customer service calls. You got to be willing to clean a house, clean a toilet, you know? And so if somebody's not willing to do that, I had a person come work for me and they said, you know, Joe, after like two weeks, they're like, you know, I don't think this is the right fit for me, because came here to learn about, you know, real estate and business development, not change locks and, or flip locks and change toilets. And I was like, well, how do you think I got started in business development and real estate? You know, is changing locks and flipping toilet, you know? So,
do you have any manure and shovel around there too, to really find out if they like to get their answer?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We've got cows, pigs, chickens, horses. So we got plenty of chores to keep people entertained. So.
Well, you know, so basically, will they get their hands dirty, right? That's the third thing you ask. You know, you want to know. You probably don't ask. You just try to figure that out. Will they get their hands dirty? Because you're right. To lead people in any respect, right, at any level, you know, great people want to be led by great people. And people that are going to work their butts off want to be led by people that work their butts off that'll do what they're asking them to do, right? So, you know, not that a leader should be stuck every day doing what they're asking people to do, but they ought to know how to do it. And they're respected a heck of a lot more by that team if they've been there and done it, or at least if they strive to learn it themselves and are willing to do it, right? So that's a big point. I agree. My best leaders are people that are willing to get their hands dirty and they're respected at the highest level because they are, right? That's a huge point. I agree. I gotta tell you, for me, what I learned in the last 10 or 15 years, my team, I learned back, I'm thinking it's probably 10, 12 years ago, that I went and visited a group of companies, and their biggest focus from every leader in the leadership teams, you know, at P&L, you know, I've always said, you know, P&L has been, very important for everybody to understand what that means, if they're going to be any type of management, a foreman, a leader, somebody to do a job costing, whatever, right? But eventually, about 10 or 12 years, I went to this company. We're a small group of companies. We're getting a little bigger, right? But this company was a larger group of a bunch of companies. And they taught every leader and about three levels down in leadership what the enterprise value meant to a business. So the enterprise value today, they should know what it is basically by the last quarters of P&L, right? And in the last year, last quarter, and the industry, and what the industry values their business at, whether it's a multiple of the revenues, a technology company, let's say, a multiple of EBITDA, net profit, whatever it is, the leaders had to know that. So from then on, I was all about hiring the right people and then to help train my team with myself. I kind of got it because by that time I was growing my businesses and you know, selling one once in a while or buying one here or there. So I got it, but I wasn't teaching it very well. I had some of my leaders that were totally concentrating on top line, some on net profit, some knew the importance of EBITDA on their business net, and they're looking at EBITDA, right? But no consistency. So for the last 10 years, my leaders in my business are totally focused on enterprise value on a daily basis, on a quarterly basis, annual basis. And they understand their industry. And in today's market where the economy's changed, our business values have gone up or down depending on, you know, what they do and what industries they're in. And some of our businesses, two of them are technology-driven businesses. Those are valued on multiple revenues, right? A big multiple revenues. And those leaders of those technology businesses know that if they get to a SaaS model, a monthly fee, right, which they're getting to, the value goes up a ton more on the multiple of revenues, right? From, let's say, 3 to 6 or 7 times multiple. It's crazy, right? And then my paving businesses, they know that if they can have a certain type of customers, recurring revenues, their value will go from 5 or 6 times multiple of the EBITDA to, let's say, 7 or 8, maybe 10 times, right? And so, again, if your leader know what the enterprise value should be today, tomorrow, and they're really focused on that, I'm telling you right now, I've been so blessed to see my enterprise value, my business grow consistently. And so I think that some of us initially in business are afraid to share those things, you know, that the numbers with our team. Oh my gosh, you know, you don't want to know how much. I have friends of mine that say, you don't want your employees to know how much you're making. That's not a good thing. I said, you know what, if I'm making 50, 60% net profit, I might agree with you. But when you're living to make 10, 15% net profit, EBITDA of, you know, 12 to 20% EBITDA, we're not gouging anybody. We're serving a market. Our profits are good, but not crazy. And when you're trying to make 10 or 20% net profit, okay, you can lose very often. And if you don't educate your team on what a loss looks like, they don't know. So they're just going every day by a number that doesn't matter. So, you know, what you're saying that with P&L is so important. And I would add to that, you know, if there's a way that you can value the business that they're operating, and I know it's tough probably in your industry, that adds an element of value that you can't get when you have your team members and leaders that care about your business a lot, that understand enterprise value. Boy, I tell you, that adds a whole another element of value in those teammates, right? So I got to tell you that's something that I agree with. If you have leaders that understand a P&L, you know, understand how to that getting your hands dirty is important, and then the differentiating factor, those three traits are big. So I appreciate that. What else would you add? Okay, when you look to leaders in the future, when you look at, you're going to grow like this, you're going to duplicate yourself and this all-star team you have probably 3 times over in the next 10 years, right? You're going to have, you know, 3 or 4 times the amount of strength and leadership that you have today. And do you feel like your organizational foundation is going to be, you know, throwing off those leaders, or do you got to constantly look?
As long as you have a mission, you know, like I agree 100%. You want employees who, you know, who understand enterprise value, and that's ultimately, you know, driving that. And that can be part of, you know, but I think what's so important to get people, particularly in a startup or high growth context, is you've got to give them a mission, because that's the biggest thing that I see people who are leaving the military feel like they lose, right? It's like, what's my mission? You know, what is the company's mission? And it's not just like a statement that doesn't mean anything, right? It's like, but really, what are we doing? You know, what, you know, and it's got to be, we're going to be the best, you know, like whatever it is, it's like, we're going to be the best. It's not like, well, we're going to manage costs to be the, like, you know, middle 40th percentile of this industry, you know, it's like, no, pick something and we're going to be the biggest and the best of this, right? Like, you know, just say, and if it's that you've got a small business in your hometown, it's going to be like, we're going to be the best, you know, we're going to be the best, you know, construction company in, you know, Athens, Tennessee, where I'm from, right? That's a great mission, right? But you know, whatever you're framing it as, it's going to be the biggest and the best of whatever your is, right? So define your pool and say, we're going to be the biggest and best of this. If you become that,
pick the next biggest pool, right? And say, now we're going to be the
absolutely
best in East Tennessee. And then, you know, like, we're going to be the biggest and best in Tennessee. And then we're going to be, you know, like, so define a pool in which you think that it's practical and reasonable and believable that your team will buy into. If you'll be the biggest and best in this pool in terms of what you do and where you do it, and then go be it. And then once you're there, then find the next biggest pool. So
I love it. Find the pool that you want to compete in, and visualize the best of that pool and be that, right? Strive to be that. And so for me, in my, you know, my younger leaders in my business think this is kind of old school, but for the last 20 years, I've been saying, I don't want to be in any business if I can't strive to be world-class in that business. And world-class is kind of an undefined thing, right? What's world-class? Well, what I tell my team is 1%. If you're in the top 1% of an industry, I believe you're world-class. And by the way, if you're top 1% in an industry in America, you're top 1% of the world, right? In my opinion, right? So for me, that's what we've been trying to do, like exactly what you say in a different way. We've been trying to define who is world-class in the businesses, in the industries we're serving, and then what do they look like? And now, if we can strive to be them, but like them, deliver a product as good as them, and then strive to kick their ass in the long run, we're in a good place, right? And we've done that successfully in multiple businesses. We failed in a couple, and those businesses aren't on board. I don't have those businesses anymore. If we saw that a business was too commoditized or we just couldn't differentiate strong enough, we've sold out of those businesses or just ended them, right? So I love what you say. I mean, if you can give your team that a purpose and a mission and a vision of what great is, right? And I say world class because I think that's an easy way to say it, even though some people it's a little vague. If I go to top 1%, and then again, my podcast, my goal is to interview top 1% people in their space and understand how they did it, how they get there, what makes them top 1%, and if they're top 1%, my book, you're world class. So that's really cool. I love the way you say that, and I agree with it too. I mean, and it has, when you can surround yourself with military, you know, people from the military, they've been part of the best army, whatever, the best armed forces in the world, right? So they know what that looks like. Okay, now let's take this to business. No, awesome, man. I really appreciate this. I'll tell you what, any. Joey's out there. Joey's listening. Joey, I haven't let you chime in yet. Joey, you got any questions for Joe?
Hi. How are you? Great. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for serving our country. It's allowed people like you to have me, when I'm from a foreign country, be able to have the freedoms and be able to learn. And so I can't be thankful enough for that. Just like you, I grew up on a farm as well, so that's always fun. One of my questions I had was, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I mean, I think of that in my family context, right? And it's, you know, what, you know, I want my, I have two sons now and hopefully have more of them. And, you know, I think about what my dad and granddad always used to tell me, remember who you are and whose you are. And so I want my sons to say, you know, that I loved them and cared for them and gave them a great, you know, future, and that I hopefully helped, you know, many other families be able to give the same opportunities for their kids. And so to me, the legacy will be in my children. So, put it in a simple way, I guess.
Thank you. That was amazing.
Where did you grow up on a farm?
In Rockford. So I actually come from a family of 22, and we there was 18 of us, and we had 18 pigs at one point in time, and we did the whole thing where, you know, if we grew a pig, we shared a half a pig, where we sent it to a different farm and they would give us a half a cow if we helped butcher. So, and then I, you know, grew up on a farm where we worked with other farmers, where I did detasseling, milked goats, made cheese. We did a lot of stuff as kids. So.
Here, I'm gonna come hire you away from Gary to come help me run my farm. So,
yeah,
watch out.
Yeah, I actually know how to plant and harvest and stuff like that. Learned that from my dad. He's he's the one who taught me everything, work ethic and all of that. So definitely working on a farm teaches you really, you know, good work ethic and getting dirty, especially shoveling manure.
Yeah, right.
I agree. Work ethic from a farm is amazing. And a lot of our leaders today in our businesses are people. I search for farmers. I went to school at a farming community, and it wasn't from a farm really. I moved there the last couple years of my life, and I was a big football player, and we had an amazing football team for such a small school because we had these big farm boys that had farm boy strength, and we just kicked the crap out of these city schools and stuff, and it was so much fun to be a part of that team. And so after high school, I would hire people in my paving business to. And the ones that would lapse are the farm boys. The ones that would stay late, the farm boys, right? The ones that could fix the paper when it broke down were the farm boys. So again, I believe in farmers in a big way because for my business, still today, my leaders, my partners, superintendents, and my businesses often come from the farm. So that's a good point to make, Joey. What else you got for him, Joey? What other question you got for Joe?
Well, I mean, you hit some good ones. Let me see here. Well, I guess I could just, outside of your businesses, what do you do to loosen up, fun family activities that you'd probably, that you do with your family when you're not busy, buying up land and running your business?
The farm, goats, chickens, cows, horses, pigs, hunting, that's basically my vacation is going out and fixing some fence or doing something on the farm.
Are you selling chicken eggs at all? The reason why I say that is chicken eggs are going high in price, and that was something we did as kids, was sit at the end of our driveway and we would sell dozen eggs. So we had to know, we had a carton of 12, 24, 36. So we had to know numbers, but chicken eggs are going high in price right now.
Yes, they are. I am, the rate I can charge is artificially constrained by that. Most of our customers are friends of ours from church. And so my wife is, limits my supply and demand, the extent to which the demand, supply and demand can drive price. So we do sell them. We could probably sell them at a higher rate.
Yeah, come on, honey. We're 10 cents off. I mean, 10 cents less than the going rate should be fair. They're better eggs, right?
That's right. So,
don't give them away. Joey comes from a family of 22, as he said, 18 adopted. And Joey's from Haiti originally. Came here when he was 5 or 6 years old.
Oh, I was fine.
5 years old, and had lots of challenges in his life that he's gotten through, and it's an amazing story. But Joey's an example, right? A person that loves America, loves the free enterprise system, blessed to be part of this great country like you and I are. That's something that that I talk about a lot in this podcast, because I mean, I wouldn't be able to do what I did. I started with nothing. To get to where we've gone is incredible, and we're so blessed to be part of this great free market, free enterprise system. Joey gets it as a young man that he is. He gets it. He knows what Haiti looks like. My son Nick is his roommate there. Nick, we adopted from Russia when he was 2.5, and Nick gets it. Nick understands the opportunities this country has, and how much better off he is here than Russia, if he was raised in Russia instead of the adoption that we were blessed to be part of with him. And again, it's guys like you that fought for our country, serve our country, and then go work and build something in this country that, in my opinion, are the coolest. And I think Joey agrees with me on that one.
Yes. Another crazy question. What do you got on your farm, like animal-wise, stuff like that?
So we have horses, cows, chickens, goats, and we're pigs. Pigs are coming on in about a week or two. We just bought the farm a couple months ago. When we moved on to the farm, the day after we moved on, I was up at night and I created a Google sheet with a task management system, And so I had my wife, my wife's parents live with us, or in-laws, the farm manager, and I had everybody on this task management stuff. And so Rachel says, yeah, I got on and, you know, first day on our dream farm, and I've got 175 tasks with, you know, degrees of importance, due dates, everything else on it. So we'd try to stay busy and are trying to get the farm up and running, but still just a couple months in right now.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome. Let's hear a little of that from you, Chris, so we can leave our listeners with those final thoughts.
Yeah, awesome. All right, yeah, thank you, Joe, so much for sharing your time. You are wise beyond your years, man. I was like, please don't be younger than me. Please don't be younger than me. But you are. big ups to you. Remember who you are and whose you are. I think that's words to live by right there. You have to give employees a mission to keep them engaged and motivated. There is no place in scaling for ego. No place in scaling your business for ego.
Mm-hmm.
Ask new hires if they have P&L responsibilities. Great way to figure out if they would be a good hire. And get a good partner to keep you from bankrupting your business 6 or 7 times.
Yes, that's the most important one.
I want to have one last one. Think about process before people. Minimize labor and maximize processes.
Yeah. One of my other favorite sayings is, you know, we're not here to give people jobs. We're here to do a job, you know? And so that's another one I like to, particularly for my military folks, to have them keep in mind. So,
yeah, that's great. Where can our listeners find out more about you and Patriot Family Homes?
So we go to our website, www.patriotfamilyhomes.com. And if you're interested in coming to work for us, there's places to do that. If you've got homes you'd like for us to manage, or, you know, convert from long-term rentals to short-term rentals, we do single family, we do multifamily. We even convert timeshare. So, you know, anything that you want to do in the kind of short-term rental space, we'd love to help you. If you've just got capital and you're wanting to invest it and want us to help you put it to work, we're happy to do that as well. So we love partnering with folks.
Well, Joe, you're awesome, buddy. Really nice hanging out with you today and listening to your story. You're a great young man and a great American. So we appreciate you being on the show. You're going to do amazing things in your life, and we're going to watch from the outside. And if you need anything ever, we'll leave my cell number with you. After this, we'll send it to you. But you need anything from me ever, I'm there for you. And really appreciate you as a person. So thanks so much for being on our show today.
Just need you to get elected governor of Illinois. turn that state around. So
yeah, it's a tough task, but you know what? Eventually somebody's going to do it.
That's right.
God bless you. Thanks for being on our show. Thanks for everybody for listening to Ditch Digger CEO. I'm Gary Rabine. And until next time, see ya.
If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo.
Cans, paper routes, mowing lawns, careless hands. Daddy had 6 kids to raise. Factory and night. Learn by example, not the words you said. Watched his every move and followed his footsteps.
Come on.
Pick and shovel in these 2 hands.
To the
suit wearing CEO, I'll stand. Already had nothing at all. Fearless of losing it.
work is